Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. This week we're bringing you an interview with Oz Guinness. Guinness is an author and social critic. He's in demand around the world as a speaker on issues of society and public policy and on matters of faith. A fact about Oz Guinness that people love to tell, I know I certainly do, is that he's the great-great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the famous Dublin brewer. More on that a little later. Oz Guinness has had a fascinating life. He was born in China in World War II, where his parents were medical missionaries, and he had a front row seat to the Chinese Revolution in 1949 and was expelled from the country in 1951. Educated in England, he's lived in the US for over 30 years. Guinness is well known for his emphasis on the subject of truth and for arguing against moral and cultural relativism. The latest of his many books is Last Call for Liberty, How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat. That was published in 2018. We talked about wild living in the 60s, working out a Christian faith in that context, the contribution of Christianity to Western culture, and plenty more. I began by talking to Oz Guinness about his childhood in China, the communists coming to power and the reign of terror there, and what kind of mark that left on his life.
Well, I was born in China, and we lived in north central China in the Henan province. And we were actually there in the horrendous famine of 1945 when 5 million died in 3 months, including my two brothers. So my mother was a surgeon, no food, no medicine. And when we tried to move, there were 10 million refugees in the road. So it was an incredible time. Now, I don't remember that firsthand. I was only 3 and 4. My parents told me afterwards. Then we moved to Nanking, now Nanjing, which is the capital of nationalist China. That part I do remember very well.
Yeah, well, that must have been an incredible experience. Not many Englishmen would have been able to tell the stories you can tell about that.
Well, my dad was a real adventurer, I would say almost a bit of a madcap. He used to love racing around on a Harley Davidson. And he had absolutely no fear. And so the idea that we were in danger never came across to me at all. They had incredibly straightforward faith, absolutely no fear. So looking back, there was an element of excitement. I wouldn't quite say a lark, but it was extraordinarily exciting.
Now, you went off to school in England and you came to faith late high school. And you've talked about the fact that books were really important to you in that. Importantly, some great atheist writers like Sartre, Camus, Nietzsche. What was it that those writers kind of gave you?
Well, I wasn't the slightest bit bookish. I love reading and always have. I love sports. I wish I'd been better at cricket. I did play for the school at rugby, but I like cricket far more. But I read a lot then. On the one side, people like Nietzsche and Sartre and Camus. I mean, Camus was actually my hero of the three. And the other side, people like Pascal, G.K. Chesterton, Dostoevsky, and of course, C.S. Lewis. And eventually, I was just convinced the Christian faith was true. But when I went to London University, this is the counterculture, drug, sex, rock and roll, the so-called youthquake. You know, the faith that I'd been given didn't relate much to what was going on. And we had incredible teachers like John Stott, Martin Lloyd-Jones, but we had these square, deep blocks of faith and theology, and next to nothing about what was going on in the culture. And then I was invited to hear this man, Francis Schaeffer. Little man, goatee, Swiss knickers, I mean, unusual. He connected all the dots and showed how you could think freely about anything and everything Christian. It made sense. And for the first time, my faith and the crazy, wonderful culture of the 60s all came together.
Yeah, it's a fascinating period for you, and especially as many people kind of rejecting faith, and yet you were sort of arriving at it.
Well, they rejected the 50s faith, formal, somewhat stuffy, external and all that, hollow. And so in the 60s, you had to think for yourself, you had to think back to square one. It was a brace. I'm so glad that I'm a child of the 60s. It was wild, but I'm glad it forced me to think through my faith and to relate my faith to all that's going on. My first visit to America was in 1968 at the end of the 60s. And that was the year when Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated and much of America was burning. There were police riots in Chicago. It was dramatic. And I met Mario Savio in Berkeley, who led the free speech movement. So it was fascinating. Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick, you know, and I went to Bob Dylan concerts, and you know, it was an incredible time. In Europe, you could go to any crossroads, and there'd be six hitchhikers. Hitchhiking was safe then. One would be reading Nietzsche, one would be reading Siddhartha, one would be reading Robert Heinlein, and one would be reading C.S. Lewis. And they'd say, hey man, you should read this, or you should go there. People were really thinking, and you stayed up till 2-3 in the morning, debating and arguing and so on. And then around 1972, it all collapsed. The 60s decade led to the me decade and the narcissism, and that intensity of the wrestling and interest in culture all disappeared.
Yeah, it's interesting. So do you find the level of debate and discussion and thought a little bit superficial these days and less engaging compared to...
Far less intense.
Yeah.
I mean, when I went to the Le Brie community, Francis Schaeffer, about 40 in the dining room in his chalet, and after you'd had soup, meal always lasted in the evening about 3 hours. You had soup, and then he'd say, anyone got a question? And then it flowed.
I'm just going to jump in here. Here, Oz Guinness is referring to Le Brie, which is a study centre in the Swiss Alps set up by Francis Schaeffer, a Christian theologian and philosopher in the 1950s. Today, these centres are all around the world. In the 1960s and even today, people turn up at Le Brie to read and study and discuss matters of meaning and purpose and faith and God and world religions and that kind of stuff. My wife did this in the 90s, and I know young people doing it today. And as is typical of these things, it was a very influential time for Oz Guinness.
And I was mid-20s, but when he was away, I was put in the hot seat. And you could get, why is there something rather than nothing? And get into heavy philosophy. People angry about Vietnam. Or I remember one night a girl said to me, I believe as a non-Christian you should be able to have 15 orgasms a night. How many do a Christian think is right?
You have a good
single
answer
man, I hadn't. You know, another night, someone about as far away from me as you are now, he said, I have a power stronger than Jesus. While we're talking, you're going to be looking into my eyes, and in 2 minutes, you will bow your head on the table. And I sort of felt my eyes locked into a beam like that. Fortunately, Edith Schaeffer out in the kitchen heard this, and they stopped to pray, and it didn't work for him. But you move from the intellectual to the political to the philosophical, the sexual,
and
then the supernatural, just like that.
Fascinating. Now, people always bring up the fact that you're a descendant of the famous Dublin brewer, Arthur Guinness. But I'm interested in the fact that he was himself deeply influenced by the Methodist preacher, John Wesley. And I wonder if you can trace that sort of influence through the line of your family to yourself today, the Wesley influence.
Well, he came to faith through the Irish Revival and the preaching of John Wesley. But for me, it's always been the sense, you know, earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can.
Yeah, that's a great word.
And my ancestor Arthur built that generosity. There was health care for the workers, education, sports care, death club, all sorts of things. And the wages were always that little higher than the wages in Dublin. So at the time you had three specifically Christian companies. You had two Quaker ones, Fry's and Cadbury's, the chocolate maker, and Guinness. And it was built on generous Christian principles, and he had a big old Bible sitting on his desk. Now, he wasn't a Methodist, he was Church of Ireland. And so I don't think Methodist runs much further through the family, but some of Wesley's personal
influence. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, there's not much Methodist.
And I have Wesley's autograph at home, a very rare autograph, and I'm very proud to have it.
Yes, indeed. Now, you've never shied away from challenges to that faith that you picked up as a young man, but what have been the biggest challenges, the most significant things that kind of have really made you rethink your faith or challenge your faith?
One of the lines I love, not from Wesley, but from George Whitefield, he says in his journals, "I'm never better than when I'm on the full stretch for God." In other words, when you out beyond your comfort zone, you either die or grow. So in the late 60s, I decided to go to study under a guru. The Beatles and many others were going out. So I went out to all the places Westerners were going, Rishikesh, Goa, Kathmandu, places like that. And the time with the guru was tough. I mean, he was spiritually powerful, philosophically very astute. And for a week or two, I was really wrestling. But when
you were trying to test your faith in this environment.
Well, I wanted to really understand what they were saying. So it was a test of faith. I wasn't deliberately trying to test my faith. But the day I suddenly saw it and grasped the differences between the gospel and the Christian faith, I came away with wonder and gratitude. My faith grew. You know, my doctorate at Oxford is in an area called the sociology of knowledge. It's a forbidding area, topsy-turvy with relativism. And again, for a while, my head was spinning to get a grasp of this. But when I did, I came away again with a sense of wonder and gratitude at the contrast of the gospel. So I always think when I put myself out beyond my comfort zone and do something really challenging, in the long run, that's how faith grows.
This is Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. And today I'm speaking with American author, speaker, and cultural critic Oz Guinness, who is, yes, the great, great, great grandson of the Dublin brewer. I actually neglected to ask Oz Guinness whether he enjoys the dark brew, which was a mistake, but I'm going to assume that he does. He also speaks and writes a lot about freedom, a topic that's of broad contemporary interest. And I asked him what he means when he talks about freedom and what he's trying to promote.
Well, think of freedom in the Western world. Let my people go. The Exodus is the master story of English-speaking freedom. There are others. You think of the Greeks, you think of the Romans and other things, but the Western English-speaking love of freedom comes from Exodus.
This is the Old Testament story in the Bible.
Exactly.
Of the Israelites, Moses coming out of Egypt and being set free.
Yeah. That is the ultimate regime change and all sorts of things you can see there. For instance, the American Constitution, it is a national secularized form of covenant. And many Americans don't even realize that. It was the Reformation rediscovered it in the book of Exodus. Calvin, Zwingli, John Knox, Oliver Cromwell, and it jumped the Atlantic because in England it was the losing cause. The king came back. But what was the losing cause in England became the winning cause in New England. So I've been fascinated with the biblical roots of freedom. And you could say today, you look at, say, the Babylonians and Assyrians, no freedom. Everything was in your stars. Or you look at the Greeks, Moira, fate, destiny, no freedom. Or you look at the new atheists, Sam Harris and others, freedom is an illusion. Freedom is a fiction. And the fact is, outside the Bible, there is no strong view of human freedom. But in the Bible, God is sovereign. Christians sometimes say, where does the Bible talk about freedom? Well, what is sovereignty? It means that God can exert his will with no interference or obstruction. He is supremely free. And a sovereign God has made us in his image. We're not sovereign, but we are significant. And freedom is that gift of God through which we most resemble our Creator. And freedom in the West does come from the Bible.
These days, though, a typical Westerner's definition of freedom is something like unlimited choice. Why is there a poverty in that definition?
Gertrude Stein once said, a rose is a rose is a rose. And people think that you can say freedom is freedom is freedom. No. Freedom is tricky. You've got to know what you mean and how you can achieve it. So, for instance, one of the big differences in terms of freedom, as Lord Acton, who's the great historian of freedom, said, freedom is not the permission to do what you like. It's the power to do what you ought. Or put differently, Isaiah Berlin, the Jewish philosopher, says, freedom is both negative and positive. Negative freedom is freedom from. No one under the control of any outside power, a colonial power or a bully in a playground or drugs or alcohol, no one under outside control is free. Freedom from. But that's only half of freedom. That has to go on to positive freedom, freedom for, freedom to be. And of course, the Christian view of freedom is both. So Jesus says, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. But most young people in the West, they have a libertarian view. Get the government off my back financially, conservatives say. Get the government off my back sexually, the liberals say. Then we'll be free. That's only negative freedom, the permission to do what you like. And that always ends up as a permissiveness that ends in license and undermines itself. And as Plato said a long time ago, democracy always produces dictatorship because it ends in mob rule and anarchy.
Is this what you mean when you talk about the paradox of freedom? There's a sort of way in which, in certain ways, can eat itself.
The greatest enemy of freedom is freedom. And that's the paradox. So free societies are rare, and they rarely last. And people are complacent about freedom are really foolish, because the hard part of freedom is not to win it. You know, a revolution like the American Revolution won freedom. Most of our countries, we just inherited it. In Australia, you just inherited it. You didn't win it. And it was ordered for you, roughly. But the third part, sustaining it, is a challenge to us all. And people don't even think about it. How do you sustain freedom? And without that, it disappears. As, you know, the great French theorist Montesquieu, he says, you need structures of freedom. That's the law and the constitution. That's only half of it. You need the spirit of freedom, which are the habits of the heart, his disciple Tocqueville says. And that has to be sustained in every generation or it dies.
So you need a degree of freedom from a kind of oppressive systems, but if you leave it there, you're stuck. You need something, freedom, yeah, to actively do something worthwhile. Is that
That's right?
Right. Yeah. Now, when Christians talk about religious freedom, they can often sound like, especially to the secular person, that they're just trying to defend their own territory. And sometimes I think they are. But when you talk about religious freedom, I think you're talking about more than that, aren't you?
Religious freedom was the term which was useful because everyone, when it was coined, was religious pretty well. But the trouble is today with many secular people and diverse religions, people think that religious freedom is freedom for the religious. No, it is freedom of religion and conscience for everybody, whether they're faiths are transcendental, let's say the Jewish and Christian faiths, or naturalistic, like atheism and secular humanism. It is for everybody. And it's a huge mistake Christians made when they just care for their own freedom. I remember a Jewish journalist saying to me 30 years ago, some evangelicals talk of justice, but he said, I know what they really mean, just us. But the simple fact is, when Christians fight for the freedom of others, then their freedom is more surely protected.
It's part of the problem that people have this sense that when Christians had the opportunity to do that, they didn't do it well enough. And now they're kind of calling for religious freedom.
Yeah, but great opportunity, because everything's up to grabs now here in Australia, certainly in America and in Britain, and we've got to think it through. You've got to think through why freedom is rightly called the first liberty. Yeah. A lot of Christians don't know that. A lot of secular people don't know that. But you've got to choose the model you want, the option you want. And I put it down to three, and I think two of them are bad. One is what's called the sacred public square, where some religion or other is either preferred or established or even a monopoly. Trouble is, those who don't share that religion are second class. So that view is unjust and unworkable for everyone who doesn't share it. And you've got mild versions, take the Church of England. And then you've got draconian versions, say Iran, where the poor Baha'i catch it in the neck, or Pakistan, where Christians are persecuted, or Myanmar, Burma, where the Muslims, the Rohingya, are persecuted, and so on. So the sacred public square is dangerous in our modern diverse world. The other extreme is the naked public square. Remove all religion. The trouble is 80% of the world is religious. Then you surreptitiously smuggle secularism in through the back door. But that is equally unjust and unworkable because most people are religious. The alternative is the middle way, which is beginning to emerge, called the civil public square, where everyone, all faiths, are free to enter public life, engage public life on the basis of their faith, freedom to be faithful. But here's the big but. Within a politically shared and agreed framework of what is just and fair for everybody else too. So a right for one is a right for another and a responsibility for both. Or a right for a Christian is a right for an atheist, is a right for a Jew, a Mormon, a Muslim, a Hindu, you name it, every faith under the sun in a particular country. Now you have to teach the three R's, rights, responsibilities, and respect. And if you teach that well, parents to children, teachers to students in schools, you create a civil public square, which is the answer to how we live with our deep differences.
Now, you have a strong sense in the West today that people have forgotten the story that shaped them, which largely comes from the Jewish and Christian story. Why does it matter that people know that about their culture?
You could start either looking at history itself and its place in human wisdom. You know, as people like Churchill says, the further back you look, the further ahead you can see. Or as Goethe said, he who does not know the last 3,000 years is living hand to mouth. But for people who are, say, people of faith, like a Christian, you can see in the Bible the extraordinary importance to the Jews of remembering. Now, as remembering is the key to gratitude, the key to faith, the key to obedience. And Moses, again and again and again, remember what God did for you. Remember the road you traveled. Those who deny history, and most modern people have no interest in history at all, they're like people with amnesia.
What did the Romans and the Greeks give us as well, apart from, you know, good roads and things like that?
Well, our Western culture is a product of three broad roots. The first is the Greeks, and anyone can think of that. Philosophy, science, democracy, the arts, various things. We owe a huge amount to the Greeks. We owe actually more than people realize to the Romans. Supremely, governance. They were great at government. And you can see the influence there if you go to the Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill and the U.S. Senate. All these words are borrowed. You have a Senate here. All these words are borrowed from Rome. And of course, they had, as you said, roads, and they also had central heating, long time before the rest of the West did. But the principal debt we have, the gifts we have, are biblical. We owe it to the Hebrews. So you think of things like our sense of history, or our sense of human dignity, or our sense of freedom, or of justice, or of community through covenant, or of the requirement of transmission. All of these are biblical. We owe far more to the biblical roots than people realize, and we are today a cut flower civilization, or as Malcolm Muggeridge used to say, those who deny these things are cutting off the branch on which they're sitting, which is just plain folly. Now, of course, Greece and Rome and Israel were all Mediterranean. And it was the conversion of the barbarian kingdoms from the Dark Ages to year 1000 through the gospel. I'm very proud to say as an Irishman, that's the great period of our history, the land of saints and scholars sent missionaries in flimsy little coracles right down to France and to Switzerland and northern Italy and so on. And they brought the Bible and the gospel and literacy and education and sowed the seeds for what became, for better or worse, Christendom.
What, in your estimations, is the most significant gift of Christianity to the West, whether you're a believer or not?
Well, let me mention the Reformation, where it's clearer, because the Reformation is said to be the single strongest set of ideas that made the modern world. And again, there are a number of C's. I'd mention three. calling. Someone like Max Weber even said that calling is behind the rise of capitalism. In other words, purpose, dynamism, entrepreneurialism through calling. Or the notion of conscience. You know, the early church, Tertullian, Lactantius, had a notion of religious freedom. The first reference to religious freedom in history is from Tertullian. But the Catholic centuries contradicted it tragically with the Inquisition and so on. And it was rediscovered by Thomas Howells and by Roger Williams and by William Penn, Isaac Bacchus, and people like that. That was the rise and contributed to the rise of human rights. It wasn't the Enlightenment. It was people like Bartolomé Las Casas in Latin America or William Wilberforce. You remember the little medal he struck? The slave in chains in the middle, and then the question, am I not a man and a brother? And it's that sort of thing through which conscience created human rights. And the third C is covenant. The Hebrew covenant, through the Reformation, jumps to Scotland and then to the United States and becomes the US Constitution. And you can see how powerful that idea was.
The Western conception of all people being made in the image of God is a huge grounding for human value and human rights and so on. Are we in danger of losing that, do you think?
It's often said today that we're not only post-truth in our postmodern world, we are post-human rights. In other words, people outside the West say, oh yes, you talk of human rights, that's a Western thing. Can you ground it in all the other philosophies of the world? No, and so on. So the Chinese and many others reject it openly. Now, it's true that the Universal Declaration took place against the revulsion against the Nazi barbarism. But it's important to recognize it was the expression of the Jewish Christian Western view of human dignity. And the charter was actually drafted by a Roman Catholic brother, Charles Malik, who was the Lebanese ambassador to the UN. So it is a profoundly Christian and Jewish document, which was considered the Bible of liberal ideas for humanity and now is increasingly rejected. So we've got to go back and see that Genesis 1 and 2, repeated in Genesis 5, is quite literally the statement that humans are made in the image of God is the Magna Carta of humanity. And that's where it all comes from.
These days, people will say, well, we've had a history of this, but even if we don't have the belief anymore, we can hold on to the value and the dignity of individuals. Do you think they can?
No. Nietzsche is really vehement against people like that. He said, if God dies, everything on which once rested on God goes too. And he looked at people like George Eliot, the English writer, and he called them odious windbags of progressive optimism. In other words, if God is dead, morality that was dependent on God has to go too, and of course, human rights and freedom.
Well, many of these great atheists that you mentioned earlier were very clear on these implications of there being no God. And they didn't think it was good news, did they?
No, they certainly didn't. And you can see in our history what happens when you deny that. So Nietzsche's ideas are picked up by Hitler, but we can't just look at Hitler as an extreme. You look at people like H.G. Wells, Margaret Sanger, and many of the so-called liberals of the 1920s, they believed in sterilization, eugenics, abortion, and a whole package of things. And people like Richard Dawkins are beginning to sound like that again today. No God? Why are humans different? John Gray, the philosopher, says this is the cardinal sin of the Christian faith. It made humans different from animals. And if we don't have a reason for seeing them as higher, people would treat them as animals, and that's what's going to happen. And we're going to see things like abortion's already rampant, but sterilization, eugenics, and enhancements against human dignity growing all the time.
Now, it's fair to say that most people don't wander around in their everyday lives thinking, well, what does it mean to be a human being? Yeah. But you're in the business of trying to get people to think about the implications of their beliefs, the foundations of their beliefs, their worldview, if you like. How do you go about doing that?
Well, a worldview is like a lens through which we see reality. And we will not only see certain things if the worldview is clear and accurate, there will be things, if it's not, that we don't see. So take a simple example. You see a mountain. The Greeks might well have worshipped the mountain. South African engineer would look at the mountain, can I mine it and make a lot of money out of it? You know, the 19th century Englishman would have wanted to climb the mountain because it's there, as they said in the 19th. In other words, they're all looking at the same mountain, but they're looking at it in different framework. And in the same way, if you take a Hindu lens or a Buddhist lens or a secularist lens or a biblical lens, you will see reality different. And you not only see things differently, there are some things you won't see at all. So, for example, Hinduism, with its view of reality as a Maya or illusion, never produced a high view of science. How could it? It was the Reformation view of reality that produced the birth of modern science. So you see certain things and you simply don't see others. The search for a seeker is comparative. Contrast is the mother of clarity.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. Oz Guinness's latest book is Last Call for Liberty, How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please do leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends about it. It helps get the word out. Next week,
another soldier comes in and he's screaming, she's screaming, I wanted to scream, but then I noticed that he has a tattoo on his arm. Scrambled words that say peace, love, and humanity. So I looked at him and with a smile, I told him, you have a nice tattoo.